Welcome to the Spectator Podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. It's August 2016 and the best time in human history to be alive. Well, that's according to the Swedish writer Johan Norberg, who writes his cover story this week on what he calls the new golden age. Never, he says, has there been less war, disease, conflict, discrimination or poverty. His new book, Progress, is full of facts and figures making this point. He joins me now along with our editor, Fraser Nelson. So Johan, your story is almost unbelievably optimistic and won't square with what a lot of people experience in their own lives. How do you expect anyone to believe it?
I don't expect people to believe that because it seems like after I've delved into the data, I've become a bit of a bore at every dinner party because everybody's got their own favorite sort of pessimism and nostalgia about the world, saying that everything is getting worse. And what I've done is that I look at long-term data, statistics on all these things, everything from poverty, malnutrition, illiteracy to fatalities of war, the risk of dying in a natural disaster, the risk of being subjected to a dictatorship. And everything is improving. And people have a hard time believing that because they're hearing all these other messages from the newspapers, from TV news, from social media and so on. And often people prefer those anecdotes, those shocking stories to data.
But yeah, and you're not just saying things are getting better, you're saying it's the best it's ever been. I imagine there are quite a lot of people who don't feel that way.
Yeah, and the data is absolutely clear on this point. We've never seen such tremendous progress as we've done over the last 200 years and specifically during these last 20, 25 years. I mean, life expectancy at birth has increased more than twice as much in the last century as it did in the previous 200,000 years. Just since 1990, we've seen a reduction in extreme poverty around the world from 37% to 9.6%, which means that 1,000 people have been lifted out of extreme poverty by the end of this podcast. So if you were to pick a particular moment in time when life was the best, the safest, the risk of living in poverty, being hungry, illiterate, and so on was as small as possible, this is that very era right now.
Johan, in your piece, you suggest that good news doesn't sell. Fraser, you're the editor of The Spectator. Why are you putting this on the cover if you know that it won't sell well?
Well, people pick up The Spectator precisely to read the stories that other publications don't come up with. And also, this might not be, right, the biggest selling issue of the whole year, but it'd be one of the most important themes that we've done on the cover of the whole year. I actually think this is one of the biggest, perhaps the single biggest, most important issue of our times. It will shape our lives more than anything else that we read about. And it's important to know, to recognize, to tell your kids that we are incredibly lucky to be born to be living right now. Now, of course, this isn't what you read in the papers every day, but you don't buy the papers to find out how the world's slowly improving all the time. You basically want an early warning system. That's human nature. If you get into the pub, you're not going to gossip to your friends about how Mr. and Mrs. Smith next door are celebrating the happy 50th wedding anniversary. You're going to be talking about things like the scandal of their granddaughter who's just got divorced because it turned out the husband was bisexual. It's these kind of details which fascinate us as human beings. I mean, Nassim Taleb, the philosopher, he once put it very well. He said that you can't really judge the world by reading the newspapers. It's like trying to judge a city by spending a night in the A&E wing of a hospital. You only ever see what's going wrong.
And Johan, this picture you're painting, is it easy to cherry-pick figures to make your argument and to actually avoid statistics which don't prove your argument?
Well, we all know that it's easy to lie with statistics, but it's even easier to lie without statistics. And what often happens when you look at dramatic media stories about something that happens is that they look at a very short-term trend, something that has become much worse since last year. For example, we had a nice summer in Sweden this summer, so a lot of people took a swim and more people drowned than last year. And then that's news, because that's the shocking thing that we instantly need to know about. And then what you need to do is to look at the long-term statistics so that these brief ups and downs, that they're concealed by the longer-term trend. And then we realize that we've reduced the risk of drowning by some 90% since the 1950s in Sweden. And that's the case in most areas. of course, bad news sells, and it's easy to find bad news because something bad is always happening somewhere around the world. And that's another reason why I think we're so obsessed with this return of pessimism. The world is falling apart right now as well, because we've got a very aggressive global news cycle, in a way. You know, once upon a time, we didn't even know that a small Asian city was wiped out by a cyclone, or we heard about it months later. Now we've got cell phones recording everything so that we see everything in real time. So there is a natural disaster going on at any single point in time. There's always a serial killer on the loose somewhere. And when we've got global media and social media, that will always top the news cycle in every country. So then we get an exaggerated sense of how often these things occur.
And you talk about geopolitics. In Europe at the moment, there's a huge amount of populism and anger, and the same in America. Are all these people just deluded?
I think this is one of the reasons why this discussion is very important, because I think that this pessimism, this radical nostalgia, really creates the breeding ground for a lot of populism and a lot of attempts to really turn the table over and actually ruin some of the preconditions that we have for progress, like free trade, globalization, openness, and things like that. Where does that come from? Could it be that life has actually become worse for certain people? And in a way, yes, that is true. That has happened. There has been wage stagnation, especially after the financial crisis in several places. And we know that intolerance grows as the economy falters. But if you look at it a little bit longer term, and I mentioned this in the piece, low and middle income households in the United States, where we've talked a lot about wage stagnation, their incomes have actually increased by more than 30% since 1970. And a lot of it is also invisible, because a lot of things can't be measured in GDP. For example, I mean, the fact that we have cleaner air than we used to do, that we have medical technology that saves lives, 10 years longer life expectancy, the internet, things like that, that, you know, economists try to put a price tag on that. And what they do in that case is that they ask people, so how much would you be willing to pay if you didn't have the internet, but got it back? If you didn't have anesthesia before surgery, how much would you be willing to pay for it? Well, and then you suddenly realize that people would be willing to pay everything they have to get those kinds of inventions back into their lives. So apparently GDP and our own assessment of wages and so on dramatically underestimate the progress that we have made.
And Fraser, all of this talk about progress seems quite a left-wing idea. How can you reconcile this with conservative philosophy?
On the contrary, I think this is fundamentally conservative. If you look at the people who tend to be most optimistic in politics, they tend to be conservatives, because the conservative belief is to think that fundamentally mankind is a decent, wise, industrious, left to their own devices, the country will be stronger and fairer. The left wing tend to have a slightly more pessimistic view about human nature, thinking that people are essentially selfish, and if it wasn't for the government to making everything nicer and fairer, then the world would be a worse place. So it is this optimism which does tend to penetrate through conservative thought. And in Johan's book, I can't recommend highly enough, it's chock full of these fantastic quotes. And one of them is from Jonathan Swift, saying that whoever manages to make two blades of corn grow where only one grew before has contributed more to society than the whole class of politicians put together. Now, this is the funny thing about politics. I'm a political journalist. I spend all my time writing what these guys are up to. But the real progress, the real things that take us to a better place, are done on a far smaller basis by lots of people throughout the world. I mean, and the Queen actually made this point rather wonderfully in a speech to the United Nations, where she was saying that in her decades of as head of state, she's noticed that the biggest changes came not because governments decided they would come, but because millions of people wanted them, somebody invented them. That the engine of progress isn't politics, it's somewhere else.
I think Fraser is absolutely right, and this is incredibly important, because in a way, pessimism and fear is the health of the state, in a way. If people think that when people are left to their own devices, free markets, free men, if they make a mess out of everything, then we need the government to step in constantly and regulate them and ban things and tax them and create huge public projects to sort of create a better world. That's often what happens when people are fearful. If we have a bit more of belief in what free human beings can do, then we can give them more freedom in that case.
That was Johan Norberg and Fraser Nelson. Next, Team GB is on course for a record haul of medals at the Rio Olympics. British athletes have won a raft of golds across the board in sailing, cycling, gymnastics and diving. So does this success mean the days of Britain being a nation of sporting losers are a thing of the past? In The Spectator this week, Simon Barnes discusses how the UK became an Olympic force. He joins me now. So Simon, why is Britain suddenly so good in the Olympics?
I suppose in the historic term, it's sudden. It's a process that began after the Atlanta Games in 1996. I was there and I didn't see a lot of great British success on account of the fact there wasn't any. Britain finished 36th in the medals table behind Kazakhstan and Belgium and Ireland. And there was a single British gold medal, which was won by Steve Redgrave and Matthew Pinsent. But that kind of, in a way, hardly counted because they always won one. So there was a feeling of everything was in British sport was absolutely dreadful. And it all changed shortly after that with John Major's invention of the National Lottery, of which a fifth of the proceeds were to go to sport. And money makes a lot of difference, but then you've got to spend it well. And the UK sport decided that the strategy was not to worry about things like the pursuit of excellence. It was the pursuit of medals. It was making the whole thing, as it were, if you like, the secularisation of sport, of making it a very practical, hard-nosed business in which medals were the currency, medals were what mattered. So they found talented individuals and directed them at sports that had an element of vulnerability about them, that were vulnerable to a highly trained, high-performing athlete, of which the classic example is cycling, which after the Athens game of 2004 became a sort of a killing ground for British athletes, and it's continued so. I thought the rest of the world would be catching up, but remarkably, the very, very fine sort of medal factory that British sport has become has been keeping ahead of the opposition and won a series of gold medals.
And do you think that detracts from it slightly, the fact that it is propped up by so much money?
Well, sport always requires money. We no longer live in the days of amateurism. In fact, and it's kind of questionable whether we ever did. Sport is a serious business. It's a full-time occupation, and it has been for many years. The amateurism and that kind of romanticism is basically a dream. And in practical terms, it turned out to be a way of trying to keep the working class people out of mainstream sports so that they wouldn't win anything, because we can't really have that, can we? So, yeah, amateurism was just one more weapon in the class war. What's happening now is that sport is not romantic. It's a practical thing. The idea of sport, the idea of wanting to be wonderful and brilliant of sport is romantic, if you like. But the practicalities of doing so come down to total dedication to the processes of victory at the expense of all else. People call it sacrifice. It isn't sacrifice. It's a choice. It's doing what you want to do in order to be the best you can possibly be and to win medals.
And in your piece, you argue that however good the machine, you need the athletes. Have we just got a particularly good crop of athletes this year and at the London Olympics?
Yes, we have, but it's not a chance process. It's a question of finding them, selecting them and training them. But it all comes down to the individual or to the team in the end. You can get a Chinese diver and stand him up on the 10-metre board, and he can be trained, plucked from childhood for all his life. But when it comes down to it, it's up to the athlete. I watched Fu Ming Sha, the great Chinese diver, many, many times, and she was just a wonderful thing to watch, from 13-year-old child in Barcelona to very much an autonomous person and a rebel in the games subsequently. So yes, it comes down to, you can't clone or make robots out of Attis. It's a personal choice in the end as to whether you are going to make the decision to be extraordinary and to win.
Do you think Britain can continue to have as much success if it just keeps up the funding, or is there something more to it than that that we also need to keep up?
Yes, it's a question of, what we are comparing ourselves is not an absolute scale, but against other nations. And it's a question of whether or not other nations wish to put the same resources into different sports and to challenge the Britons on what's been becoming their turf, particularly in the rowing and in the cycling, or in the sports that Britain has been invading, sports which Britons were previously no hopers. Gymnastics, classic example, won seven medals this time. And this was a sport in which Britain used to be complete no hopers. So yes, if other nations choose to invest in the same kind of talent and to make things work out, yeah, then there will be serious challenges, and the British will not have it all their own way in the velodrome, on the rowing lake and elsewhere.
And in other areas of sport, not Olympic sports, but say English football, could we apply the same technique where we fund English football and suddenly we're going to win the World Cup?
That is not going to happen in football, because football is very much a business, and the prime product of that business in this country is the Premier League, in the world is the Champions League, and international football has been very, very much demoted. It's a second or a third tier event, and the players don't really enjoy it at all anymore, and it's not the summit of what they try and do. So it would be nice to say, well, interesting, and as an experiment to say, let's take the best English players and nurture them and make them the priority. That's what's happened in cricket, but that is not a model that can be put onto football, on account of the fact the money is in the club games, not in the international game.
And just to finish off, what's been your highlight of the Olympics so far? I know you've watched a lot of them live and you're watching from the UK this time round. What's been the best moment?
Best single moment, hard to say. Probably watching Kohei Uchimura, the great Japanese athlete, retain the men's all-around championship and prove himself probably the greatest gymnast that ever drew breath. Gymnastics is a sport that's always fascinated me. It's the nearest humans get to flying without any aid. And Uchimura, he's a man who can fly, and it's been a joy watching him across the years and to what was probably his ultimate achievement at these games.
That was Simon Barnes on Britain's success at the Olympics. And finally, has the arts world had a sense of humour failure over Brexit? Lloyd Evans, who's been at the Edinburgh Festival this week, says lovies are still reeling from the referendum. He writes in The Spectator that taking away their subsidies is exposing the true colours of the arts establishment. I'm now joined by Lloyd and The Spectator's arts editor, Igor Toroni-Lalic, to talk about the lovies' meltdown over Brexit. So, Lloyd, why have all the lovies been having such a sense of humour failure about Brexit?
Well, it's partly because they don't seem to realise what it means. I mean, it means democracy, and they don't really accept that when the decision seems to conflict with their opinions. I mean, I was up in Edinburgh, and I went to lots of comedy shows, and a comedian only had to stand on stage and say Brexit and shrug in a quizzical way, and everyone would laugh. And it was really strange. I mean, it wasn't really comedy. It was kind of group consolation, which has always been an element in a stand-up routine. It's about sort of objectifying and condemning an outside actor or outside player. And Brexit seems to have taken on that mantle. So it's very odd. And I was in rooms, very large rooms, with 100 people in the audience, and the comedian would say, who voted to remain? And everyone would cheer. And then he'd say, and who voted for Brexit? And virtually nobody would hold their hand up. It was very, very strange. So it's partly that. And it's partly because, of course, the lovies will have lost a lot of access to euro money, which is being splurged around in huge, huge quantities.
So yeah, do you think it's more financial rather than political?
I suppose it is political in a way, because I think there's this supposition that Brexit was the fault of a lot of provincial people who were a bit dim. And there was an excellent comedian up in Edinburgh called Jeff Norcott, who was very in favour of Brexit. And he said, well, why are they saying that the people who voted Brexit were dim when the Remain campaign organised their major protest march after the votes had been cast. But it, you know, he was very much an exception. But I think Loveys and actors are generally assume that the state and the large bureaucracy should fund their careers. So obviously they're rather disappointed to be denied access to the huge sums available from the European Union.
And Igor, as our arts editor, have you come across this in other areas of the arts, this hatred of Brexit?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's very odd because, you know, the arts establishment usually consider themselves as radical and revolutionary, and this was a revolutionary act, you know, maybe one of the most revolutionary things the British have done for hundreds of years. And they don't seem to understand this or be able to capitalise on this, which just shows up their lack of imagination, which is very sad and a bit surprising that people in the arts don't have a lack of imagination for these things. They could capitalise on this, but they're not.
Because surely it could be quite a creative period out of this unknown. They could be creating great things, but you haven't seen that happening.
Massively. Hopefully they will, once they stop whining, get down to it and do some great work. But at the moment, I think they're just thinking about the subsidies that they're going to be losing, the sort of middle-class problems they're going to have sort of with visas, even though I imagine that that won't be such a big problem. But I think a lot of them are worried about that. So as soon as those sort of worries subside, hopefully they'll get on with it. But at the moment, they're completely obsessed in a really sort of strange psychological way.
And Lloyd, obviously you've seen this at Edinburgh. Have you seen it elsewhere in other, you know, other creative areas?
The fear of Brexit and the consequences of Brexit. I think we're only just beginning to see it. But you know, it's very odd that actors always imagine that the state should fund their careers, and they always say that actors always gain their first experience in a subsidised theatre. And that's why we should subsidise the theatres. But in fact, most actors gain their first experience in the school nativity play, or possibly in the sixth form version of Romeo and Juliet. So really, we should be putting billions into nativity plays and into sixth form Romeo and Juliet productions, rather than into the National Theatre and to the subsidised fringe. But I mean, yes, it's an interesting question. And there are some theatres now which are openly inviting plays about Brexit. But I mean, it takes about, you know, a year or 18 months to really get a play up and running from scratch. So we won't yet see the productions coming through. But I imagine they will be around, and I suspect they will take a very malign view of Brexit, because that is really how actors and creative types tend to regard the vote, which is unfortunate, because they've become anti-democratic activists, which is a peculiar thing for an artistic and creative person to be.
It seems slightly strange, given that 52% of the country voted for Brexit, to then take this position, because surely it isolates quite a large part of the potential audience for these shows.
Yes, it does. That's right. Yes. And I suppose in a way, you know, picking up on what Igor was saying about creative people usually being rebellious and revolutionary, I think they're likely now to see themselves as the minority who are fighting back against this terrible decision made by, you know, knuckle-dragging people with not enough A-levels to their name. So they'll probably still manage to feed that in, that sort of rebellious element in their work, into the kind of Brexit plays and the Brexit operas, perhaps, that we'll see, and the Brexit films, maybe.
And Igor, can you imagine artists and theatrical types heading abroad because they're so fed up of what's happened here?
Well, a lot of them have already. I mean, there's a lot of expat musicians and theatre makers in Berlin and various other places, because life is cheap and stuff. They may sort of stay out there, but I imagine that actually, you know, London is still a sort of commercial centre. The fact that it's a commercial centre does trickle down into the various art forms. I mean, there is a reason why the art market is based here, why, you know, the music scene is so sort of is thriving here. It does help to be commercially savvy, even in the subsidised industries. It all trickles down and affects even the most radical art and music that's going on. So I think they'd be shooting themselves in the foot to move abroad.
Lloyd, do you think people are going to be invigorated by this, that artists might actually want to come here precisely because we have voted for Brexit?
Well, they seem to be flocking here in their droves anyway, and you know, the country appears to be booming. And last time I checked the medal table, we were, you know, nudging second position in the Olympics. So something seems to be going well. I hope more people will come here. Yes.
That was Lloyd Evans and Igor Turani-Lalic on how Brexit is going down in the arts world. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.